Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. If you're hearing this for the first time, it is July 2nd, 2017. And I had a really interesting week last week. I was guiding for the Jewish Women's Renaissance Project again, which is always a really terrific experience. The senior guide for the project is my friend Ken Spiro, and he agreed to talk to me about some of the other things that he does when he's not running 200 women around Israel in 45 degree centigrade weather like it was at the Dead Sea on Thursday. Anyhow, Ken, thanks so much for joining me on the Land of Israel Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Eve.
So first of all, what about this week? What did you think? Is it ever the same? The groups that come, you probably lost count how many groups you've done, right, in the last few years. Tell us a little bit about, for those who didn't hear my show when I interviewed Lori Palachnik, who came up with this whole idea, but maybe fill my listeners in exactly on what this is.
Sure. I actually know Lori from before she was Palachnik, and she herself came back to her Jewish roots probably about 30 years ago. But I've been working on the program since it started, which is probably about 7 years. I long since lost track of how many JWRP women's groups. I was on the first trip of like a couple of buses once a year to now they have, I think, 6 back-to-back trips, meaning there's 200 women, there's 200 women. There's also men's trips now. And the program's gone through a lot of permutations, a lot of changes. The biggest change is that the Israeli government jumped on board a couple years ago. They were so impressed with the program. People ask, what's JWRP? A lot of people describe it as birthright for mothers, which is not exactly accurate, but that's the closest program I could think of. They basically take Jewish women who are married between the ages of, I don't know, something like 30 and 55, who still have children at home, who are not religiously observant, and they bring him on an 8-day trip of Israel, which is pretty much, except for the airfare, subsidized completely. And it's just an amazing experience of seeing the land of Israel, learning about Israel and Zionism and Judaism and spirituality and growth and relationships. This fantastic program. Of all the programs I'm involved in, I do a lot of speaking and outreach work. I think this is probably the most impactful. It's a great experience.
So by being impactful, what are you saying? That a lot of these women go home and they get more involved in their Jewish life than they were before? You have numbers? You have any kind of feedback? It's been a few years already. You might see where this has gone.
Yeah, well, first of all, the way it works, it's not just random women. Cities have to, organizations in cities, whether they're outreach organizations or federations or a synagogue, or they have to basically recruit, partially pay for, bring the women, and most importantly, follow up on them. Mm-hmm. So the experience, you know, Israel, the rabbis say the very air of the land of Israel makes you wiser. So just taking women, getting them out of their homes, no kids, no husband, just letting them have really a spiritual growth vacation for 8 days in the land of Israel, where the energy is just such an intense learning experience. So I don't have statistics. I'm sure if you contact the JWRP office, you'd get them. But I do know that cities like Detroit, Cleveland, where they brought hundreds of women, it's transformed the city. Because when you change women, you know, they always say, you change a guy, you don't change anything. You change the woman, you change a home, you change enough homes, you change a community, you change enough communities, you change the world. So I definitely see, because I also go on speaking tours, that there are cities where there are literally hundreds of women who've gone on it. And not that they've all become observant, but they've definitely moved forward in their Judaism. You know, many of them put their kids in Jewish schools. A lot of them actually start going to the mikveh once a month. There's all kinds of interesting. They make challah, whatever it is, whatever you're doing, moving forward. It's very transformative. And for probably a lot of these women, it's the first really positive Jewish experience they've had, where they've been able to understand not just Israel, but understand that Judaism is something that's meaningful and relevant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for a lot of these women, it's their first time in Israel at all, which I found really surprising. They didn't come on like a birthright trip when they were younger. Sure. So a lot of them are coming to Shalim, seeing the Kotel for the first time, just feeling, just listening to a lot of people speak Hebrew around them, ordering pizza in Hebrew, and just seeing a Jewish country. And I see them change from day to day. It's really interesting. For the guides, it's also challenging because we are bouncing around on the buses. So we don't really get to know everybody, but we get to know everybody a little bit. So I find that that's a really interesting facet of the week. So there's just this report that came out a couple of weeks ago about Judaism mainly in North America, and how it's not so much intermarriage that is the problem as Jews are not getting married and having or having children, which it seems to be happening all around the world. And that's why the Jewish numbers in the States are dropping. So, like, what do you think? You go around and you speak on a lot of different topics. You're a historian, and you do, you're involved with a lot of different things. What's your sense when you go to the States? You live here full time. You've raised your family here, but you go to the States a lot. So you really see both sides. How are you seeing this, and how is it affecting how what you can give to the JWRP? Because you know what they're going back to, where they're coming from, and what they're going back to. You're not just seeing them for the 8 days here in Israel. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, intermarriage is a huge issue in America. The intermarriage rate is over 60%. And if you take Orthodox Jews out, it's over 70%, according to Pew Research. So combined with, as you said, the Western world is suffering from extremely low birth rates. It's one of these sort of, I don't know if I would use the word narcissistic, but people just don't like to, you know, dealing with kids is an expensive process. And you right. see, it's not a new thing, by the way. The Roman Empire, 2000, Augustus Caesar had to try and pass laws forcing men to marry and have children. Mm-hmm. So it's a byproduct of affluent progressive society at all periods of time in history. And the Western world is plagued with low birth rates, below replacement rate. In the Western world, you have to have 2.1 kids per family to just maintain your population. In the Jewish world, I believe Jewish women have the lowest or one of the lowest birth rates in America of any ethnic group.
Really?
So if you combine the low birth rates with the intermarriage rate, mm-hmm. I call it demographic suicide. But there's another bigger problem is the apathy and the lack of connection to Judaism in the land of Israel. I grew up in a generation where, you know, I grew up post-Holocaust, but the generation my parents lived through the Holocaust, and there was universal across the board support for Israel and a very deep appreciation of, you know, the need to perpetuate the Jewish people and rebuild the Jewish people. And also, we didn't have all the politically correct stuff in there. So I see the big change as I travel is that university campuses are, I would say, borderline insane when it comes to certain topics. And ethnicity, while being cool and acceptable, is cool and acceptable for everyone but Jews. It's quite fascinating that Jews who are one of the smallest minorities in the United States, 1.7% of the population, are never looked at as a minority because they're white, generally. Not all Jews are white. I have a son-in-law who's Ethiopian, not Ethiopian, excuse me, who's a Yemenite, who's darker than most African Americans I know. Right. But most Jews in America are Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe. And because Jews tend to be affluent and because they look like the dominant and educated, they don't have minority status. So while it's cool to be, and there's an obsession with certain ethnic groups in America, especially with blacks, you know, but Jews seem to feel almost guilty about their identity. And combine that with what's going on with the Israel bashing on university campuses, and you have a massive disassociation of young Jews with a Jewish identity. And add on to that the open attacks against mm-hmm. those Jews who actually are somewhat connected. Mm-hmm. What started out as this ridiculous BDS movement has morphed into open anti-Semitism. So it's not like these kids are walking around campus with a We Love Israel shirt and one an Israeli flag tied around their neck. You walk around with a mug and dovet, you're a member of a non-religious Jewish fraternity like AEPI, you're going to get abused for being Jewish. Mm-hmm. And we're just seeing anti-Semitism hiding behind, often Israel bashing or whatever other things it hides behind in today's politically correct world, coming out with vengeance. And university students who tend to be sort of left-wing, it's sort of de rigueur to be on the left when you're that age. It's sort of part of the official platform of the left to be anti-Israel, to be into BDS. It's very, very scary. So you take Jews with little or no Jewish identity who don't know about Israel, who don't have really appreciation of their ethnicity, the richness of their culture, and you put them on a campus where everyone's telling them that their essential identity or the country that is made up of their people, Israel, is like this evil apartheid state. And it's just doing horrible things to Jews on campus.
Well, then you had this crazy story last week in Chicago where there's a pride parade and only the Jews are asked to leave. The people with the rainbow flag, but a Magen David in it, are asked to leave. And a flurry of articles like, what's that all about? And, you know, so even the Jews aren't accepted anywhere. We're not accepted because we're Jews. We're not accepted because we're white. Can we not do anything right?
Well, unfortunately, there's sort of a coalition of ideologies that make up the left in America, and they all seem to adopt certain universally held platforms. Mm-hmm. That Israel is an evil apartheid state is a package deal that comes along with this identity politics of the West today. And you just can't be, you know, I talk about the extreme example I love talking about is Israel happens to be one of the most gay friendly countries on the planet Earth. It always appears like the top of the list. There are pride parades in every city in Israel. Yet there's an organization called Queers for Palestine that accuses Israel of hiding behind its tolerance of gays to mask its genocidal policies against the Palestinians, which is, of course, crazy. Mm-hmm. There's no genocidal policy against the Palestinians, and the pride parade is never going to be held in any Arab state. They would hang in Iran, they hang these people on cranes in public. Right. So it shows you the lack of real thought or in-depth thinking on the issues and how dangerous it is. Mm-hmm. But it's a given. It's a given as part of this, you know, the political situation on the campus that you can't be pro-Israel. It's just unacceptable because Israel is just the root of all evil in many ways in people's minds. And I've noticed that over the years when I was in university, you know, many, many years ago, you had a number of causes that you could be involved in to feel good about I noticed also that a lot of people who are in the extreme left, rather than actually doing something, they had to go and protest because it's sort of, I feel good without actually changing the world. So when I was in college, you had South African apartheid, and that sort of trumped everything else. Mm-hmm. And now that that's gone, the only issue, and when I say issue, because I've also noticed this, is that I should really do a book on the rules of being on the extreme left, because it's really a faith-based religious system, not in the traditional sense, but in the idea, there's certain articles of faith that you believe in, regardless of any amount of evidence.
Yeah, it's almost a messianic movement.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, but there's things you have to believe in, regardless of any amount of evidence or truth. You're not going to sway these people. And one of the things I've noticed is that the extreme left only gets excited or involved or angry when white people are involved. Meaning you have, if you look at a list of the greatest hits of horrendous humanitarian tragedies in the world, if it's like Arabs killing Arabs, Africans killing Africans, okay, people are like, but when it comes to white people involved, or even better yet, Jews and Israelis, obviously are all white people, even though again, we're really not. So that you get involved in because it's transference of your own like sort of guilt onto someone who sort of looks like you. And it's kind of, in my opinion, it's even a racist ideology because you really don't care about the people. Mm-hmm. You just care about who you think is perpetrating the violence. Mm-hmm. Because you really cared about the people, you would put your effort into those people who are suffering the most. You wouldn't be bashing Israel. You'd be screaming about Syria, where more people are killed in a week in Syria than are killed in a year in Israel in counterterrorism activities. But that's just not part of the way they think. Mm-hmm. And in this environment, you're throwing Jewish college students with minimum identity, both right. in terms of Israel and religion, and it's just toxic for their Jewish identity, for their support of Israel. And the scary part is what's going to be in 15, 20 years when these university students are the leaders of the Jewish community in North America.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of my listeners are Christian. And I know I guide a lot of Christians that come here to Israel. I know that you do also. I know that when you go to the States, you also speak to them. So obviously, the talk that you're having with them is not Jewish continuity because that's not their narrative. So how do you talk to them about Israel and about their role here and what's going on? Because I know from some of the Christians that I'm in touch with and very friendly with that they're seeing the same thing with their kids. A lot of them are homeschooling, forget university level, even in the grade school level they're homeschooling because they find God has been completely taken out of any kind of curriculum, and what is happening in America is absolutely appalling. So I think they're even more ahead of the curve here on what's happening in the United States on a large level than the Jews are. So how do your conversations go when you go to the Christian communities?
Well, first of all, it's very true. And I have to say that when I speak to Christian audiences, well, they definitely have a different worldview. And I think they sort of think and look about the world in a different way. Their worldview is very much more similar in so many issues. I have to say I often have much more in common with them with a lot of my very liberal Jewish friends. Mm-hmm. Because we're coming from, although, you know, we have different ideas about God and Messiah, etc., we're coming from a certain worldview about it, deterministic worldview in history, a God and absolute morality. And these are paradigms which are not shared by very liberal Jews or the left. And you're 100% correct. I know a lot of my Christian friends are homeschooling their kids. They realize that universities are toxic for a lot of different reasons. The faith-based system of the left is antithetical to their worldview. I saw a statistic in the East Coast of the United States, liberal professors outnumber conservative 28-1.
Wow.
So to send your kid to an environment like that is
and spend $50,000 a year for the pleasure. 50.
I went to Vassar. It's now $64,000 a year tuition and board to learn nothing applicable and probably have your brain more trashed than it was before you came in. But the other thing that I say about when my Christian audiences is, you know, I get a lot of this. I'm one of the few rabbis who speaks to Christians. A lot of rabbis don't want to be associated with them. Orthodox rabbis, I'm talking about especially, although I don't think it's very different with Reform either. Although they're scared of Christians for a different reason. They're scared of all. They tend to be often very afraid of religious, very religious people, whether it's Orthodox Jews or Christians in general. But when I'm talking to these people, I notice a certain when I say these people, I'm talking to Jews who are very paranoid about Christians. There's big misconceptions about Christian support for Israel and the Jewish people. The most common point they always say is they just want all Jews to come back to Israel so the Messiah will come and it'll be Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I always give the same answer. I said, first of all, A, as far as I've seen, it's not true. And B, even if it were 100% true, what would you rather have? These guys who like Jews and support Israel and are willing to vote according to our, you know, and defend us and support Israel financially even? Or you want the guys with the white hoods or the Spanish Inquisition? You know, and it's funny when I teach Christian groups, I always end with a line. I say, you know, guys, we got to agree to disagree on certain theological points. But the reality is we have a tremendous amount in common. We both have deterministic worldviews. We believe there's a God who acts in history. There's an absolute standard of right and wrong. There's a huge struggle going on here, not between Jews and Christians, but between those people who believe in that God and that morality and those who don't.
Right. This is almost like a war between or division between people who believe in God and people who don't.
Pretty much.
And the religious affiliation is a little bit irrelevant. It's that it's God versus not God.
Exactly. So I always say we gotta put our differences on hold and focus on what we have in common because we're really fighting a common enemy here. And I always tell them, you know, you work on the Christian community, I'll work in the Jewish community. We'll both do our jobs. We'll bring the Messiah. And if he's Jesus, I promise you guys can baptize me. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, it's a nice way, but they all laugh. But the real reason, my experience with working with Christians in general, is that this is the first group of Christians in history who actually takes the Bible seriously. Much more so than most Jews. They read in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, chapter 22, in Lech Lecha, as we say, the beginning of Jewish history with Abraham, where God says, I'll bless those who bless you and I'll curse those who curse you. And they really believe it. Mm-hmm. And I've heard pastors saying this, not to me. People send me recordings of them speaking to their mega congregations in like Denver, 2,500 people. And they're saying, you know, this is God is testing the nations of the world to see whose side they're on. And we choose to be on the side of Israel. Those are God's people.
So we've talked for a few minutes and we haven't mentioned Muslims and Islam at all. But how are you finding Americans when it comes to that? Are you thinking that the war, the jihadist war, because here in Israel, it's not just religious issues that we have. We have existential issues with our neighbors who want to eradicate us completely. But it's happening in Europe. It's happening to some degree in America as well. Not necessarily the religious element, but I don't know. How do you see it? Do you ever go into mosques? Are you ever invited by Muslim congregations? Because there are moderate Muslims. We know this. There are Muslims in the West who are appalled at what is being done in the name of Allah. Is there any kind of that, or it's really just Christian and Jewish audiences that you work with?
I have Muslims in audiences that I'm speaking. I have been invited to countries like Indonesia to speak that I've declined because I'm just a little too paranoid to do that. I've gone to Istanbul to speak. I've done radio shows with Turkish, actually TV show with a very interesting Turkish sort of imam who's very into universal acceptance, very moderate Muslim Islamic worldview. So there are definitely Muslims who are like that. I always say, you know, there's definitely moderate Muslims. The problem is there's not really moderate Islam. And especially the people who are speaking, so to speak, for Islam today tend to be extremists, and the moderates are too scared to open their mouths. So I would say the majority of Muslims are not violent jihadi people, but they're not the ones who are out in the street, you know, giving another face to Islam. The problem in the West is that I always say 1,000 years ago, which is not a great time for Jews and not a great time in the world during the Middle Ages, you had a fanatic Muslim screaming, Allahu Akbar, God is great, and Christian crusaders screaming, Dus Volt, God wills it, and fighting each other over the dominance of which monotheistic faith. Fast forward 1,000 years later, and by the way, the West clearly won, having gone out of its fanatic, closed-minded medieval mindset to a Renaissance and Enlightenment. But they went too far, like they overshot the finish line. Mm-hmm. The Islamic world is, in the words of David Price Jones, who's an Arabist, he said, stuck in a closed circle. I would say as a historian, the Islamic world was more progressive and open 1,300 years ago than it is today. And certainly those speaking for Islam are the most extremist, backward people. So you have a problem on both sides. You have an Islamic world, which is dominated by the most extreme factions, who I think are probably twisting Islamic law to the most extreme forms, because even Islamic law, dhimmi, Jews and Muslims, while they're second-class citizens, are not supposed to be slaughtered. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be tolerated. Okay, and but then you have in the post-Christian Europe world, which is not America, by the way. It's right. The East Coast and the West Coast and the broadcast networks and university campuses, but not the United States, which is the most religious country in the Western world, where at least
in God we trust is on the money.
85% of the people believe in God. That's why Trump won, by the way. That and total disgust with the politicals, with the party hacks of both parties, whatever. That's a whole separate topic. But the West, especially Europe, has overshot the mark and left its Christian roots too far behind. Mm-hmm. And now is the whole West is consumed by, I would say, this idea of universalism. That we all have to, I do a whole interesting talk on this, particularism versus universalism, what's correct or not. And the reality is Arab world is incredibly particularistic and Europe is totally universalistic. And it's the ultimate meaning, the Arab world believes very much in the rightness of their worldview. That's a particularism, that who we are is the best and right way.
And that's the only truth.
Yeah, that's the only truth. Universalism is like, why can't we all just put our differences aside, go listen to John Lennon's Imagine. Mm-hmm. That's the song. I always say it's the best, worst song ever written. I love the music, but the words are antithetical to everything in Judaism. You know, Jews, by the way, but that's what Europe is. Europe is, you know, it's amazing. There's a terrorist attack in Germany and Angela Merkel apologizes. If we were only nicer. If we were only less German, more, and it's, first of all, it's insulting to Muslims. It's like saying that if we would just stop being more who we were, you would stop being more who you are, which is insane. It's not the way they, there's nothing wrong with being particularistic, provided you're not aggressive about it. Mm-hmm. But at least in medieval Europe, there was a balance of particularism with Christians believing that their worldview was destined to, you know, and the Muslims believing their worldview is destined to. By the way, we Jews are fascinating. Like everything about Judaism is complicated. We're history's greatest universal particularists.
Yes, exactly.
We're supposed to be the Mamlechet Kohanim Vagoy Kadosh, a nation of priests and a holy people. We're supposed to preserve our own identity, yet Jews are the ultimate nation that has always pushed a universalistic worldview. Go read the book of Isaiah. It is the most universalistic book ever written, mm-hmm. about, you know, nations shall not the sword against nation, neither shall they make war anymore, but it's universalism based on a particularism.
And that God loves everybody, yeah, and you don't need to have to believe in Judaism in order to have God love you, go to heaven, or whatever it is. Right.
But there's certain basic tenets, mm-hmm. Allah, the seven laws that God gave to Noah, that if the whole world would follow those, there's plenty of room for diverse expression within that culturally. But if the world would just follow that particularistic worldview, then there could be a universalistic world united around that worldview. Mm-hmm. But because the Jewish people haven't been doing it and making a proper role model, because we've been completely on a defensive for centuries, the world lacks the ability to be able to do that. So you have two extremes. You have the Muslim world going one way, way too particular, and the Christian world being post-Christian and being universalistic to the point of committing suicide is what you're seeing Europe is doing today.
Well, I see Judaism as ultimately being the balance between justice and mercy, and Islam, both the two daughter religions of Judaism, Islam taking that justice way to an extreme, and as you said, Christianity taking the mercy part, the turn the other cheek, way to the extreme, because not noticing or not understanding who's coming after them, as you just said that Merkel did, which is really humiliating to the Arabs, but to Islam. But just to hark back to something you said before, I was just reading that there are quite a few leaders in Europe right now who do not have children themselves. Merkel and just many of them, May. And I wonder if that also affects their feeling. A lot of what we do in our lives is about our children and about the world that we want to leave for our children. And when you have Macron also, I believe, when you have so many leaders in Europe now who themselves, they're deciding on a future that they have no stake in. So you have to, do you think it makes a difference to how they're seeing things also? So they're going to let all these Muslim refugees in. So Europe, eventually, maybe the Muslim-Christian war, it'll be reawakened, except this time the Muslims will win because the Christians aren't noticing how dangerous it is, what they were fighting for so many years, they've now let in the front door. Mm-hmm. So how do you see that in terms of Europe? Because I'm not sure that, I think my audience is mainly a North American audience, and I'm not sure that North Americans realize how different Europe is.
Yeah.
From the United States, but that could be the way the United States goes if it's not careful.
Absolutely.
Americans don't get it, by the way, because again, America, despite the Hollywood and the extreme left in the media, is not that way, actually. America is one of the only Western countries that has a positive growth rate in its country, largely due to immigration and the birth rate of the minorities in America, like Latinos. America suffers from the same problem in the upper class, middle upper class Americans, especially like the white, you know, the WASPy, even, and the Jewish population, of course. But Europe is the extreme. People don't realize it. England is the most religious country in Europe. 50% of Brits say they believe in God, which is pathetic. But yet more Muslims, by the way, Muslims are not 10% of the British population, yet more Muslims go to mosque on Friday than Anglicans go to church on Sunday. So it's one thing to say you believe in God, but whether you take God seriously or not is a separate topic. Europe does not take God seriously. And the birth rate is the bigger issue. First of all, it's a sign of tremendous narcissism and decadence to not want to have kids. I mean, kids aren't convenient. It's much better life if you don't have to spend it on your children's education and everything else you have to do. But if the Muslims are really smart, and Mark Stein wrote a great book called America Alone, and he talks about how within 50 years, there's going to be no one in Europe who has an uncle, aunt, brother, sister, niece, or nephew. Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to be an only child of an only child of an only child. If the Muslims were smart and patient, I would say, thank God they're not. They would just pay their taxes, fake being, you know, good European universalists, and keep their birth rates up. And within 25 to 30 years, they would be either the largest minority group in every country or an actual majority. Because when you're having four kids per family and your European neighbor's having less than two, every Muslim woman is worth 3 to 4 European women. Mm-hmm. And do the math. I'm not an accountant or, you know, known as bean counter guys, but it only takes a couple generations to do that. They could literally win a demographic jihad. By the way, I don't know if people know, but the fastest declining birth rate in the world is Muslim women. Mm-hmm. But even though it's gone from like 8 to 4, it's still 4 times greater than Europe. Because why Muslim women in Europe? The only way to get people to lower their birth rate is to raise their standard of living. That's mm-hmm. the best way to get people. So when Muslims leave the Middle East and go to Europe, where their standard of living goes through the roof, especially in Sweden, where everything's paid for. So, okay, they only have 4 kids, you know, instead of the 8 they would have if they were living in, you know, Sudan or something like that. But you're right. It actually, you're witnessing the death of Europe and of Christian Europe. And the scary part is you're witnessing, if you look at the elections in Europe, you're witnessing the rise of the right. Because the extreme right, whether it's Le Pen or Geert Wilders in Holland or all these people, the extreme right is only a reaction to what's happening on the extreme left. You have those Europeans who are particularistic, who want to preserve the European identity, are going to migrate to the political parties that are most extreme. And they're the byproduct. Who's responsible for those? The European left is responsible for the creation of the European right, because most people are politically moderate. Only when they get desperate do they go to extremes. Mm-hmm. If you go to Eastern Europe, which, by the way, is an unbelievably racist place, the Eastern Europeans have, these are post-communists. They don't buy any of the nonsense. They don't any of the fluffy liberal, you know, they want the prosperity and the economy, but they trust me, I spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe. First of all, they're incredibly racist. It's scary, but they have no problem preserving their ethnicity mm-hmm. and putting extreme building fences, putting extreme limits on immigration into their countries. They want to maintain their identity. And I'm not saying it's ideal or not, but if Europe were a little more moderate in its dropping of its obsessive universalism, you'd probably have a lot to say for Europe and a future for Europe that's not there at the moment.
Well, Brexit might be a key that even some other people are getting fed up, not just the Eastern Europeans. Yeah, well, what do you think?
Well, Brexit is, you know, the whole Europe, the European Union thing is the ultimate expression of universalism. Mm-hmm. And we see that, first of all, economically, it didn't work, you know, because economies, you know, if I was Germany, I don't know why I'd want to be linked to the economy of Greece or Spain or Portugal. It's crazy. But then again, it gives you massive power because you're the one functioning economy there and you really can call the shots in Europe in a way that's almost imperialistic. But it's a tremendous attempt to try and minimize the difference between people, and people don't want their differences minimized. People like to be. I know in Zev McGann's book, John Lennon and the Jews, he has a great line. He says, no woman wants to be told by her husband that she's loved like he loves every other woman. People want to feel special. And being special doesn't mean you have to be a racist. As a matter of fact, the more you play up in a gentle way your differences, the less you get extremism. The more you go in either way, the more you push people to the extremes is exactly what you're seeing in Europe.
So now let's jump to the States, because are you seeing that in America? Are you seeing this last year? And you came back and you said to me, they're having a nervous breakdown in America. and, you know, they have not recovered from the last election. So are you saying that same thing, that the overwhelming push of the left and their values in the media and the universities is what led us to the administration that we have today in Washington?
I mean, the Trump phenomenon is unbelievable. When they write a book on 20th century politics or the last couple hundred years, this is going to go down as one of the most fascinating, because Trump is much more, in my opinion, a byproduct of what's going on in the American mind than of who he is personally. I just spent a couple weeks in America on a speaking tour. It's unbelievable. The left has, I literally lost it in America. They can't get over that they lost. They keep stirring fake news and these Russian, there's nothing there. Anyone who's the slightest bit objective, and by the way, the incitement coming is that the fact that they go into a baseball field and start shooting. Trust me, if I said this, that I was in America when it happened, if a right-wing NRA Tea Party guy had done that, oh my God, this would be in the news for 2 months after every story. We got to shut down talk radio. We got to shut down Rush Limbaugh. We got to shut down all these guys. We got to get rid of the... But it's crazy. The real incitement, I see, it's scary. I've never seen a country so divided. I think a lot of it happened during Obama's presidency. The first black president caused more racial tension in America since when I was a little kid in the 60s. It's unbelievable with the Black Lives Matter thing. So America is in turmoil now, but I think the Trump phenomenon is a byproduct of, despite, you know, and anyone who listens to Trump, like the guy is like, the things he says, or like he tweets, or like he did yesterday, I couldn't believe the things he tweets. But the reality is Trump is more of, I think he's more of a manifestation of how fed up Americans are with the political machine in general. It's not the Democrat, they're fed with the left, they're fed up with the Republicans also. They're fed up with people who are professional politicians who are just basically interested in their own needs, and they want something different. And Trump is as different as you can get. I mean, you can't get more different. He is the first guy elected who doesn't owe anyone any favors. He says exactly what he thinks. He's the biggest loser, in my opinion, in the last election was not the Democrats, who were trashed, by the way, but the media, the mainstream media, which is overwhelmingly lopsided towards the left in America. He won the election on Twitter. It's an unbelievable thing. Someone should write a book on that. And the people say, you got to stop tweeting. I mean, if I was Trump, I would never stop. I might tone down my tweets, but I would never stop tweeting. He can do an end run around the media, which is always acting as a filter. So it's such an interesting phenomenon. I'm right in the middle of it now. But I think it's really a reaction, just like you see in Europe. Trump is not an extreme. It's funny. Trump is not an extreme right-wing guy. He's actually pretty liberal. He's not. Tea Party guys don't like him because his moral stance is very much to the left of theirs. So it has much more to do with people getting desperate and depressed about where America was going and wanting something totally different outside the box than it has to do with, I think, Donald Trump's personal moral agenda or vision of America. But what you do see that Trump ran on was Make America Great. And I remember, I think it was Mark Simone or Sean Hannity, I heard on the radio. He did this montage collection of speeches of Obama and speeches of Trump. And it was scary, and you hear it all together. It's speech after speech of Obama apologizing for the United States. Going back to what I said about the white guilt, you know, like we're guilty. Speech after speech after speech after speech about how bad America is. America is not a bad country. America is the most benign superpower in human history. I'm sorry. It's not a perfect country, but boy, a lot of the British compared to the U.S., right. What they did with their empire, the French, the Spanish, the boy, come on, give me a break, the Russians. Yeah, and then you have, and then you listen to Trump all about particularism. You know, make America great, America first. It's funny because he's turned out to be much more proactive in the world than people thought he would be. People thought he was going to be a big isolationist. He hasn't turned out to be that way so far. But that also says that there's a huge chunk of America that is A, fed up with the political establishment, and B, believes that America is a great country and wants to, and doesn't feel guilty about America and wants to preserve that unique American identity, whatever that is. That's the particularism surfacing again. So it's all part of a populist kind of thing you see going on in the world, that both in Europe, in the United States, even with Putin. He's a popularist. I mean, mm-hmm. he's restoring Russian pride after what happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So this is the mood. And what does it tell us? It tells us something about human nature. It tells us that people like their differences and want to preserve them. Mm-hmm. And also tells us if you don't do it in a moderate way, you get in an extreme way. And that with the whole world, we do much better to be more centrist and not so extreme in either direction.
But I mean, we see that here in Israel, and also talking about Jewish identity. You know, we're sitting here saying Jewish state, going against the world. I think that's probably why Europe isn't happy with us, because they're trying to blur the lines. And we're saying, No, we have some particular identity. And I do feel that Israel can be an example to the world of how you can balance that particularism and that universality, as in addition to being a society that's very much based on faith and family. And again, I'm not saying religion, I'm saying in particular faith, because a lot of Israelis would not say that they were religious, but I think most Israelis do believe in God, and there's a distinction there. So as opposed, this is what I'm feeling, and that's why I want so badly for people to understand Israel in its proper context and come and visit if they can, because we talk about being the light into the nations, and for a long time we talked about it in terms of the moral values and the Torah, etc. But I think that we came home now because there's a political reason for us to be here as well, to show that you can have a nation that does have that balance, that does have the values, that is open to the world while still maintaining something of what makes us unique and not be embarrassed about it. And what's interesting is American Jews are embarrassed about Israel. And I've heard more, the very, very, very leftist American Jews have said to me, Israel, and I've talked about it on my show, anybody listening here knows what I'm talking about, know how much it bothers me because I've mentioned it more than once. Israel makes me embarrassed. The things Israel does makes me ashamed to be Jewish. You know, so it's like they're nutty. But has this kind of thing ever happened in history before? You know, I look at how the Roman Empire fell apart, and they had what was called, right, panvikirkas, like very cheap food and water and entertainment. Mm-hmm. And I go to the West and you see everybody's into their rock games, their sports games, and all the entertainment. Everyone's walking around with white strings coming out of their ears, right? Because nobody's paying attention to anything that's happening. And so that's the entertainment. And McDonald's, $5, and you got your 2,000 calories for the day. So, and then we know what happened to the Roman Empire. Are you, as a historian, as somebody who really has understand how we got to this place today, if you could fast forward 10 or 20 years and look back at now, are you seeing signs that are worrisome beyond Trump is out of control in his Twitter account and this is happening with the Europeans? Are you seeing that there's a possibility for a really devastating kind of situation here that we're primed for in the West today, 2017?
Yeah, well, they say, you know, the more things change, the more they say the same. And you don't learn from the past, you're going to repeat it. That's a George Santayana line. So there's no question that all great civilizations in human history go through similarities in what happens, periods of great productivity and expansion. And then you basically get to a point of too much comfort and stagnation and decadence. Rome had it for sure. It's not just Rome. Every empire has it. Is the West going through it? Absolutely. Is America going through it? Yes, but somewhat less, because there's still a certain spirit in America that is not so decadent. But it's certainly a huge problem.
Are we at some kind of a tipping point?
I don't know if we're at a tipping point, but, you know, the big change is technology, the ability to share information. I mean, the world has moved to a place where you can let everyone in the world know something instantaneously. So it's one of the things when you're in the middle of it, you can't really know how it's going to happen. When they write the book on this period of time of how people's brains have been affected by the fact they have smartphones and tablets and computers and you don't have to know anything anymore, or how the ability to, that everyone, there's no filters anymore. Everyone can blog and write. You can go wherever you want for news, and it's a completely unrestrained access to information for better and for worse. So I'm a little hesitant to make predictions about what's going to be, but given that human nature is always human nature, and people tend to do the same stupid things over again, there's certain patterns that are definitely repeating themselves now. And I think the world is at a very critical point. Whether it's going to be that radical Islam is going to prove to be a huge threat to the world, I don't believe that's the issue. I believe radical Islam is a byproduct of a sickness in the Western world. It's not a struggle between two superpowers. If the West decided it wanted to end Islam, the West could end the Muslim world in 24 hours if it wanted to. There'd be nothing, I'm not saying this should, of course, right, but literally in 24 hours, there'd be nothing left of the Muslim world. So it's not a struggle between two superpowers. It's what it is. It's the biggest problem with the West is the West, not the East or not the Middle East. It's exactly. And that's where the Jews, in my opinion, fit in. Mm-hmm. The job of the Jewish people has never been to conquer or colonize or convert the world. It's always been to show the world how you're supposed to think and live and act. And the world needs values now more than anything else. The world is like, it's like a rudderless ship, what's going on in much of the world, or at least the part of the world that gets to talk and speak and influence university campuses, the media. The tension is being caused by the grassroots people who are still thinking and have a value system, resenting how they're being told top down how they should think and how they should, and they don't believe that way. But the reality is it's the world's in a dangerous place. What's going to happen? I don't know. I don't know. We tend to see in history that civilizations tend to vacillate from one extreme to the other. you know, the left is in, then the right is in. People get sick of that and they move to that. What we need is the middle, and the Jewish people are supposed to supply the middle. We're supposed to give the world the balance.
Well, what would you like to see happen?
What I'd like to see, well, first of all, I don't believe, as a historian and also as a believing Jew who believes in the unique mission of the Jewish people, I don't personally believe the world is going to be able to find that balance until the Jewish people, until we get our act together as a people, mm-hmm. stop apologizing for everything, start being Jews for Judaism first, because we got Jews for every other ism but Judaism. And again, I always say Jews for Judaism is not because you want to preserve the tribe and not give Hitler a posthumous victory, but because we're the God squad. The Jewish people changed the world. We gave the world the idea of one God. For a teeny tiny people, we have influenced the world, as John Adams says, more and more happily than any other nation, ancient or modern. What's his name? Wrote the book, The Gift of the Jews. Totally spacing his name out now. Yeah, but I'll remember in a second. But you know, he says that this, the basic software that Westerners process the world with is Jewish software. Mm-hmm. And the problem is we're not giving the world upgrades, because we Jews have been in such a reactive mode for so long that we've forgotten that the purpose of being Jewish, even religious Jews think the purpose of being Jewish is to perpetuate the Jewish people, learn Torah and do the mitzvot, do the commandments. The reality, the purpose of the Jewish people is to do Kiddush Hashem, which is to sanctify God's name, which means to act in a way that people look at you and say, wow, look at how this person lives. Look at his family. Look at his relationship with his wife. Look at his children. Look at his community. Look at the values these people have. Like, we want to be like them. Mm-hmm. And again, because we're the universalist particularists, we're the only people, I believe, who are able to give the world that vision they need, so they're not vacillating from one extreme to the other like you see in the world today. So the reality is, if you put that all together, that the onus of everything going wrong in the world is ultimately responsibility of the Jewish people. That's a fundamental belief in Judaism, that Abraham chose for himself a unique responsibility, and that the Jewish people, you're born into that responsibility. You can individually run away, you can intermarry, but collectively we can't disappear, because if we don't rise to that occasion, rise to that responsibility, you know, the world's in big trouble, and when they get in big trouble, they're going to come after us first.
So the non-Jews are going to look at us because we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing in order so that they can be living the lives that they're really supposed to be living.
Which is,
so we've got a lot on our shoulders.
Which is also why it's a crazy double standard in the world. Why Israel, 26 UN condemnations in 2016, 20 against Israel and 6 against every other humanitarian tragedy in the world. As unfair as it is, it's God's way of telling the Jewish people, you know, like Hebrew National commercial, we have to answer to a higher authority. I always say being Jewish might not be comfortable, but it's always meaningful. The world's always going to remind us that you Jews and you Jewish state Israel, even though you've created an incredibly, you know, you talked about dynamic, a society that is a Jewish state, yet is a democracy, which seems to be impossible. Yet Israel in many ways balances that better than almost any country in the world, given that it is so specifically a Jewish state. But we're supposed to be taking it up to the next notch and really creating a Jewish state that's not like every other nation, but that's a light to nations. Mm-hmm. And I always say that we're only going to get peace for the Jewish people in the world in Israel when we have Jews for Judaism and we're proactive and we're really the light to nations that we're supposed to be.
Okay. All right, Ken Spiro, thank you so much. I could talk to you for hours and probably will, but not on the mic. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoyed. If they want to get in touch with you, how can they do so?
Oh, so I have a very good website. It's got a lot of good content on it. It's Ken Spiro, KenSpiro.com. Tons of free content. You can listen, read, and watch for free, and you can also contact me through there.
Okay, you heard that. All right, everybody, have a wonderful week. I know that I fully intend to. Eve Harrow Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. Take care, everybody. Goodbye for now.
Who are we as a people? Who are we as a nation? What does it mean to be a Jew in the Land of Israel, as a Jew in Judea? What is our message to the world? We're finally back in our land, and we get to ask these questions.
Be'ezrat Hashem, we're going to make Judea and Samaria an issue for the entire world to know that the Jews have a place in the world.
Israel Inspired with Aria Bromwoods and Jeremy Gimpel on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.